A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headaches.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. The race for sovereign AI compute is officially hitting a fever pitch, and it is not just about who has the biggest pile of GPUs anymore. It is about who actually controls the infrastructure that the entire future economy is going to run on. Today's prompt from Daniel is about the anatomy of these national AI supercomputers, specifically looking at Israel's recent moves with their national AI program.
Herman Poppleberry here, and man, this is a meat and potatoes topic for me. We are seeing this massive shift from nations just being consumers of AI, you know, renting time from big American cloud providers, to trying to become power brokers by owning the iron. Israel just announced the first phase of their national system going live with those NVIDIA B200 chips, and it is part of a much larger $330 million strategic play. By the way, today's episode is powered by Google Gemini 1.5 Flash, which is actually a perfect meta-commentary on what we are discussing. Large-scale models requiring massive, coordinated infrastructure.
I love that we are using a model to talk about the hardware that builds the models. It is very circular. But let's start with the basics, because the term supercomputer sounds like something out of a 1950s sci-fi movie where there is one giant glowing tower in a refrigerated room. Is that what we are actually talking about here? Is it just one really, really beefy computer? Or is that a marketing term for a bunch of smaller ones taped together?
It is definitely the latter, though taped together might be underselling the engineering. In the old days of supercomputing, like with the IBM Blue Gene or the Cray systems, you often had these very specialized monolithic architectures designed for linear algebra or weather simulation. They were built for what we call high-precision floating-point math, extremely accurate but very rigid. But an AI supercomputer in 2026 is fundamentally a distributed cluster. Think of it as a massive fleet of high-performance servers, or nodes, all talking to each other at speeds that would make your home fiber connection look like a tin can on a string.
So if I'm a startup in Tel Aviv, and I get access to this national supercomputer through the Telum program, I'm not literally logging into one machine named the Brain. I'm getting a slice of a massive distributed network. How many chips are we actually talking about for a national scale?
The Israeli specs are impressive. We are looking at around 4,000 GPUs in the full build-out. They started with 1,000 B200s provided through a partnership with Nebius. To give you some perspective, the B200 Blackwell chips are significantly more powerful than the H100s that were the gold standard just a year or two ago. We're talking about a massive jump in FP8 and FP4 performance. Those are the lower precision math formats that AI models love because they are much faster for training and inference.
Wait, can you pause on that lower precision part? If I'm a scientist, don't I want more precision, not less? Why is FP4 a good thing for an AI supercomputer?
That's a great catch. In traditional physics simulations, like modeling a nuclear reactor or a bridge, you need 64 bits of precision because a tiny rounding error can make the bridge collapse in the simulation. But neural networks are different. They are noise tolerant. Think of it like a painting. Traditional supercomputing is like trying to map every single atom in the paint. AI training is more like impressionism. You just need the right colors and the right general spots for the brain to recognize the image. By using 4-bit or 8-bit precision instead of 64-bit, you can cram way more calculations into the same amount of silicon and power. It's the difference between a scholar writing one perfect sentence an hour and a speed reader scanning a whole library in a day. For AI, volume and speed beat surgical precision every time.
Okay, so we're trading precision for raw throughput. When you have 4,000 of these things linked up, you're looking at exascale levels of AI compute. But the magic isn't just the chips, it's the interconnect. You need things like NVIDIA's NVLink or InfiniBand, because when you're training a massive model, the GPUs have to talk to each other constantly. If the talk between chips is slow, it doesn't matter how fast the individual chip is, the whole system chokes.
Imagine you have 1,000 chefs in a kitchen. If they all have to share one single cutting board, it doesn't matter how fast they chop, they're going to be standing around waiting. The interconnect is like giving every chef their own station and a pneumatic tube system to pass ingredients instantly. In the Israeli setup, they're likely using the latest Spectrum X Ethernet or InfiniBand fabrics. We're talking about bandwidth in the hundreds of gigabits per second per link.
That makes sense. It's like having a team of geniuses, but if they can only communicate by sending letters in the mail, they aren't going to solve a complex problem very fast. You need them in the same room shouting at each other. But I have to ask, why 4,000? Why not 40,000? If you're a nation-state, why stop at a number that some private companies have already eclipsed?
That's a sharp question. It's about the efficiency frontier. For a country the size of Israel, 4,000 B200s is actually a massive amount of accessible compute. If you build a cluster of 100,000 GPUs, the power requirements alone become a national security concern. You'd need a dedicated nuclear plant just to keep the lights on. By sticking to the 4,000 to 8,000 range, you provide enough horsepower to train state-of-the-art specialized models without bankrupting the Ministry of Energy. It's about being a Tier 1 player without trying to be the only player.
But how does that work in practice? If a private company like Meta has 30,000-50,000 GPUs, doesn't that make a 4,000 GPU national cluster look like a toy? Can you actually build anything competitive on that scale?
You can because of model specialization. Meta is building general-purpose AI. They want a model that can do everything from writing poetry to coding. That requires massive scale. But if you're Israel, and you want a model that is the world's best at analyzing satellite imagery of desert terrain, or a model that understands the specific linguistic nuances of Hebrew and Arabic for regional security, you don't need 350,000 GPUs. You need a highly curated dataset and enough compute to iterate quickly. A 4,000 GPU cluster is more than enough to train a sovereign model that outperforms GPT-4 on specific national priority tasks. It's the difference between a massive cargo ship and a fleet of high-speed interceptor boats.
So, technically, how does a government-run cluster differ from just buying a bunch of instances on Amazon Web Services or Google Cloud? Is the hardware actually different? Or is it just about who owns the deed to the data center?
It's a bit of both. When you use public cloud, you're often on a multi-tenant system. Even with dedicated instances, there's an abstraction layer, a hypervisor, that eats up a little bit of performance. It's like renting a room in a hotel. You're sharing the plumbing in the hallways. A national AI supercomputer is usually built for bare metal performance. It's like owning the whole house and stripping the walls down to the studs to run your own custom wiring. It uses parallel file systems like Lustre or GPFS because AI workloads don't just need compute, they need to ingest petabytes of data at unbelievable speeds. If you try to do that over a standard cloud storage setup, you hit a bottleneck immediately. Israel's system is designed specifically for the training phase of the AI lifecycle, which is the most resource-intensive part.
But wait, if I'm a developer, isn't the software stack on AWS or Google way more user-friendly? Does a government supercomputer come with a clunky interface? Do I have to fill out a form in triplicate just to run a Python script?
That used to be the case with old-school academic supercomputers where you had to use these ancient job schedulers like Slurm and wait in a queue for weeks. But the new wave of sovereign compute is different. They are partnering with companies like Nebius or internal tech transfer units to make the developer experience feel like the modern cloud. You get Kubernetes, you get Docker containers, you get a clean API. The goal is to make it so a 22-year-old developer doesn't feel like they're stepping back into the 1990s. If the friction to use is too high, the talent will just go back to using their credit card on a private cloud.
Does that mean the government is basically running its own internal version of Amazon Web Services?
Essentially, yes, but with a very different terms of service agreement. On AWS, if you stop paying, your data is gone. On a national cluster, the government might provide credits that are essentially a subsidy. They might also provide preloaded national datasets that aren't available on the public internet. Think of it as a walled garden that actually has better soil than the outside world.
And this isn't just an Israeli thing. You mentioned the EU, the UK, and the UAE are all doing this. The EU has their Euro HPC initiative, which is like 7 billion euros. Are they all building the same thing? Or is there a different flavor of supercomputer depending on the country?
The hardware is somewhat standardized because, let's be honest, NVIDIA has a near monopoly on the high-end silicon right now, though we are seeing some diversions into specialized chips. But the flavor comes in how they provide access. The UK's Isambard project, for example, is very focused on academic research, life sciences, and climate modeling. They use a lot of ARM-based processors alongside the GPUs to focus on energy efficiency. The UAE's approach with their AI700 fund and their G42 partnership is very much about building a national champion model, like Falcon. They want to own the base model for the entire region. Israel's model seems uniquely focused on the startup nation, Ethos using the compute as a literal subsidy for innovation to keep their local AI companies from fleeing to Silicon Valley the second they need to scale.
That fleeing part is interesting. Is it really about the hardware, or is it about the money? If a startup needs compute, they usually raise a Series A and buy it. Does the government providing the hardware actually change the brain drain, math?
It changes it significantly because of the cost of capital. If you raise $20 million from a VC, and $15 million of that goes straight to NVIDIA or Microsoft for compute time, you've effectively given away a huge chunk of your company just to rent some silicon. If the government says, keep your equity, use our silicon for free or at cost, that startup stays leaner and keeps its leadership at home. It's a massive incentive to keep the corporate headquarters in Tel Aviv or London rather than moving to Palo Alto.
But what about the maintenance? GPUs aren't like roads. You can't just pave them and walk away. They break, they overheat, and the software drivers need constant updates. Is a government agency really equipped to handle the ops side of a Blackwell cluster?
That is the Achilles heel of the whole plan. If a government tries to run this like a DMV office, it will fail. That's why the public-private partnership model is so crucial. In Israel's case, by working with Nebius, who essentially grew out of the Yandex infrastructure team, they are hiring people who have dirt under their fingernails from running massive clusters at scale. You need SREs, site reliability engineers, who are used to working at 3,000 AM when a rack of B200 starts throwing thermal errors. If the government tries to do it all in-house with civil servants, the uptime will be terrible and the startups will leave anyway.
That leads perfectly into the second part of Daniel's prompt. If the government is providing the hardware, what is the catch? Is this a backdoor for the government to decide what innovation looks like? I can see a world where a bureaucrat says, sure, you can use our 4,000 GPUs, but only if you're building an AI that helps us optimize the bus schedule or something equally riveting.
It's a valid concern, but if you look at the structure of the AI National Program, or TELEM, it seems they're trying to avoid that trap. They've allocated about 1.2 billion shekels, roughly $330 million over 5 years. A huge chunk of that isn't just for the electricity bill of the supercomputer, it's for talent. They're funding PhD fellowships and industry academia partnerships. The goal isn't to dictate the product, but to lower the barrier to entry. Right now, if you're a brilliant researcher with a wild idea for a new transformer architecture, you basically have to go work for OpenAI or Google because they're the only ones with the keys to the kingdom, the compute.
But how do they choose who gets time on the machine? Is there a committee? Because committees are where innovation goes to die. If I have a disruptive idea that sounds crazy to a government official, do I get rejected?
That's the million-dollar question. Usually, these programs use peer review panels, similar to how scientific grants are awarded. In Israel, the Israel Innovation Authority, TAI-A, handles it, and they have a pretty good track record of being market adjacent. They don't just look for safe projects, they look for high-risk, high-reward tech. But you're right, there is always a risk of industrial policy being too slow. That's why many of these programs are setting up fast-track lanes for startups that already have private backing. If a top-tier VC has already vetted your tech, the government might just rubber-stamp your compute allocation.
So, how does that work in practice? If I'm a startup and I get approved, do I get a bill at the end of the month, or is it totally free?
It's usually a tiered model. For pure academic research, it's often free but subject to a long queue. For startups, it's often subsidized. Compute. You might pay 20% of the market rate that AWS would charge, or you might get a compute grant where the government gives you $500,000 worth of hours. This prevents people from wasting resources on stupid stuff. If it's totally free, people will run inefficient code just because they can. If there's a shadow price attached to it, they'll optimize their algorithms.
So the government is essentially playing the role of a massive, non-dilutive seed investor. Instead of taking 10% of your company, they're giving you $1 million worth of compute time and saying, go nuts, just do it here in Israel.
Well, I shouldn't say exactly. I should say that is the strategic intent. It fills a market gap that venture capital is actually pretty bad at filling. VCs love software. They love things that scale with low capital expenditure. But foundational AI is capex heavy. It costs tens of millions of dollars just to see if your idea works. A VC might pass on a brilliant team because the burn rate on GPUs is too high. The national program steps in and says, we will cover the hardware cost so the VCs only have to worry about the payroll. It de-risks the most expensive part of the R&D.
I can see the conservative argument for this too. It's about national sovereignty. If we believe AI is the next oil or electricity, you cannot afford to have your entire economy dependent on the goodwill of a few private companies in a foreign country. If there's a supply chain crunch or a geopolitical shift, and suddenly those cloud clusters are prioritized for someone else, your national tech sector goes dark overnight.
That's the sovereign compute argument in a nutshell. It's why you see countries building these bunkers for AI. It's a defensive play as much as an offensive one, but it also goes deeper into the talent pool. One of the specific goals of the Israeli program is creating a funnel for identifying disruptive use cases. They are looking at the intersection of regulated markets, like healthcare or defense, and AI. These are areas where the private sector often struggles because the regulatory hurdles are too high. If the government provides the sandbox, the compute plus the data plus the regulatory pathway, you can innovate in ways a startup in a garage simply couldn't.
Let's pull on that healthcare thread for a second. If a country like Israel or the UK has a nationalized or highly centralized health system, does the supercomputer become a way to train models on data that Google or Meta can't touch?
Bingo. That is the secret sauce of national AI programs. Public cloud providers have strict data residency and privacy rules, but they are still third parties. If a government-run supercomputer is sitting in a secured bunker on a government-owned network, they can feed it sensitive national health records or classified defense data to train models that are hyper-specific to their population. Imagine a diagnostic AI trained on the entire genomic history of a specific region. That's a massive competitive advantage that you can't get by just renting a general-purpose model from California.
But how does that work with privacy? If I'm a citizen, do I want the government's supercomputer crunching my medical records to train an AI?
That's where the sovereignty part gets tricky. The argument is that it's safer for a national entity to do this under strict local laws than to have that data exported to a private company's server in Virginia or Dublin. Governments can use techniques like federated learning or differential privacy, where the AI learns from the data without the data ever actually leaving the hospital's local server. The supercomputer acts as the central brain that coordinates these smaller learning sessions. It's a way to unlock the value of national data without creating a giant, hackable honeypot of personal info.
Let's talk about that talent piece. Is the market really failing there? I mean, AI researchers are making seven-figure salaries right now. Why does the government need to fund PhDs? Won't the market just produce them because the rewards are so high?
The market produces applied researchers, people who can take an existing model and make it slightly better for a specific business case. But the market is actually quite bad at producing foundational researchers, the people doing the weird deep math that might not pay off for a decade. If you're a PhD student and you have to choose between a government grant that lets you stay in your home country and study AI safety or neural symbolic logic versus a massive paycheck from a big tech titan to optimize ad clicks, most people take the paycheck. Over time, that drains a nation's intellectual capital. The National AI Program is trying to create an ecosystem where you can do world-class, foundational research without feeling like you're sacrificing your career.
It's a bit like the space race. NASA didn't just build a rocket, they funded an entire generation of physicists and engineers who eventually went on to build the modern world. You're saying these supercomputers are the Saturn V rockets of the 2020s?
That's a great analogy. The rocket itself is impressive, but it's the grounding of the talent that matters. If you have the best hardware in the world, but no one who knows how to optimize a kernel for a B200 chip, you just have an expensive space heater. Israel is dedicating a huge portion of that $330 million specifically to education and research grants. They want to ensure that when the next transformer or diffusion breakthrough happens, it happens in a lab in Haifa or Jerusalem, not just in Mountain View.
I have a fun fact for you that actually ties into this. Did you know that the Technion in Israel was actually the first place outside the US to have a significant node on the ARPANET back in the day?
I didn't know that, but it makes perfect sense. Israel has always realized that being geographically isolated means they have to be digitally hyperconnected. This supercomputer is just the 2026 version of that ARPANET node. It's their umbilical cord to the future economy.
It's interesting that this is coming from a country that is already such a powerhouse in tech. You'd think if anyone could rely on the free market, it would be Israel. But this level of intervention suggests they see a looming compute divide. A world of haves and have-nots where the haves are just three companies in California and maybe a couple in China.
That is the nightmare scenario for any mid-sized power. And let's look at the numbers. The Israeli program is talking about 4,000 GPUs. That sounds like a lot, and for a startup, it is heaven. But Meta announced they're aiming for something like 350,000 H100s. The scale difference is still orders of magnitude. So, a national program isn't trying to outbuild Mark Zuckerberg, it's trying to ensure that their local ecosystem has enough table stakes compute to stay relevant. It's about maintaining a seat at the table. If you don't have the compute to at least test your theories at scale, you aren't even in the game.
Is there a risk of obsolescence here? These B200 chips are the hot new thing today, but in 18 months, NVIDIA will announce the C300 or whatever comes next. Does a government-owned supercomputer become a white elephant the moment the next generation of silicon drops?
That is the biggest risk of the own-the-iron strategy. Private cloud providers like Azure or AWS can amortize the cost of hardware across millions of customers and upgrade constantly. A government has a much slower procurement cycle. If it takes 3 years to approve the budget and 2 years to build the data center, the chips might be two generations behind by the time the first researcher logs in. That's why the Israeli model of partnering with a private provider like Nebius is smart. It's more of a managed service approach. They get the newest Blackwell chips now, and the contract likely has provisions for hardware refreshes. You have to be agile, or you're just building a museum for yesterday's tech.
How does that work for the taxpayers? If the government is constantly upgrading these multi-million dollar chips, isn't that a massive drain on the treasury?
It's an investment, not just a cost. Think of it like a national highway system. You have to repave the roads every few years, but the economic activity those roads enable, the commerce, the jobs, the logistics, far outweighs the cost of the asphalt. If the supercomputer helps create three new unicorn AI companies in Tel Aviv, the tax revenue from those companies alone would pay for the next 10 generations of supercomputers. The risk isn't spending the money, the risk is not spending it and watching your entire tech sector move to a country that did.
So, what's the practical takeaway for someone listening to this who isn't a government minister? If you're a developer or a founder, how do you actually use this? Is there just a website where you sign up and get a login with gov.il button for a cluster of B200s?
Pretty much. The Israel Innovation Authority has a portal where they've already started accepting applications for compute allocation. They're looking for projects that have high potential for technological disruption. If you're a researcher, you can apply for grants that include compute time as part of the package. The takeaway is that the cost of starting a deep tech AI company just dropped significantly in these regions. You don't need a $5 million seed round just to train your first model anymore. You need a great idea and a successful application to the national program. It democratizes the training phase, which has been the biggest gatekeeper in the industry.
It's like the government is building the high-speed rail of the mind. They're laying the tracks so the private companies can run the trains. But I'm still stuck on the backdoor question. Does this lead to a sort of nationalized AI? If the government funds the talent, the research, and the hardware, does the resulting intellectual property belong to the state?
That is a sticking point in a lot of these programs. In Israel's case, they've generally been very good about letting the private sector keep the IP. That's how they built their cybersecurity industry. The goal is the multiplier effect. If $1 of government compute leads to $10 of private investment and $100 of GDP growth, they don't care about owning the patent. They want the jobs and the tax base. But in other countries, maybe more authoritarian ones, you can bet your bottom dollar that sovereign compute comes with very heavy strings attached regarding what you can and cannot build. You might find your compute allocation revoked if your AI starts asking the wrong questions about the government.
That brings up a fascinating point about AI alignment and ethics. If a government is providing the compute, do they also provide the guardrails? Could a national supercomputer be programmed to refuse to train a model that doesn't align with national values?
This is the new frontier of censorship and control. We talk about sovereign AI, but that's a double-edged sword. It means sovereignty over the AI as much as it means independence from foreign tech. A country could bake its own legal and ethical framework into the very hardware and datasets provided by the national program. It's a level of soft power that we haven't really grappled with yet. If the only way to build a top-tier model in your country is to use the government's safe hardware, you're going to build a model that plays by the government's rules.
So if the UK builds an AI on its national cluster, it might be more polite, or follow specific British libel laws, whereas a US-trained model might be more freewheeling because of the First Amendment.
We're going to see the balkanization of AI. Instead of one global intelligence that everyone uses, we'll have regional intelligences that reflect local laws and cultural norms. A French AI might have a very different personality and set of ethical constraints than a Chinese AI or an Israeli AI. And since they are trained on sovereign hardware, there's no way for a foreign power to patch or censor them. It's total ideological independence.
It's the ultimate industrial policy for the 21st century. We used to subsidize steel or semiconductors. Now we subsidize floating point operations per second. I wonder, though, if we're going to see a compute bubble. If every country builds their own exascale cluster, is there going to be a point where we have more compute than we have useful things to do with it?
I think we are a long way from that. Every time we get more compute, we find a way to eat it. It's like Parkinson's law, but for silicon. The data and the model size expand to fill the compute available. What's more likely is that we'll see a shift in how we use it. Right now, it's all about these massive, dense LLMs. But with localized national clusters, we might see more sovereign models, AI that is specifically tuned to the language, legal code, and cultural nuances of a specific country. That's something big tech won't always prioritize. Think about a model that understands the intricacies of Israeli tax law or the nuances of the Hebrew language in a way that a model trained mostly on English language, Reddit threads, never will.
That is an excellent point. An AI trained in Silicon Valley is going to have a very specific worldview. It's going to be biased toward Western liberal values, English language idioms, and American consumer habits. Having a Hebrew native or Arabic native model trained on local data on a national supercomputer actually changes how that country's citizens interact with the technology. It's not just about power, it's about identity.
And that's why the talent part is 50% of the discussion. You can buy the chips, but you can't buy the culture of innovation. You have to grow it. Israel is betting that by providing the sandboxes, the physical locations and compute clusters where people can experiment without fear of bankruptcy, they can catalyze the next wave of disruption. They're looking for the intersection of disruptive developments with mature markets. That is the sweet spot. They want to see AI applied to the real-world industries they already lead in, like water tech, ad tech, and defense.
How does this play out for the little guys? If you're a country that can't afford a $300 million supercomputer, are you just doomed to be a client state of the AI superpowers? Is there a middle class of compute?
There's a risk of a compute gap that mirrors the digital divide of the 90s. Some countries are trying to form compute blocks. The EU's EuroHPC is the best example. Instead of Belgium or Portugal trying to build their own, they pool their resources into a few massive systems that all member states can use. But for the developing world, it's a much tougher climb. They might end up having to trade data sovereignty for compute access. giving big tech companies or foreign governments access to their national data in exchange for the processing power to analyze it. It's a high-stakes geopolitical trade-off.
So, if you're a policymaker in a country that isn't doing this yet, you're basically looking at a future where you're a digital vassal state. It sounds harsh, but if you don't own the infrastructure and you don't have the talent pool, you're just paying rent to the people who do.
It's a harsh reality. We're moving into a compute standard economy. The countries that recognize this early, like the ones we've mentioned, are effectively building the central banks of the future. But instead of printing money, they're providing the processing power that generates value. If you look at the history of the Industrial Revolution, the countries that owned the coal and the steam engines ran the world for a century. This is exactly the same thing, just with GPUs and electricity instead of coal and steam.
It also makes me wonder about the physical security of these things. If a nation's entire economy is running on a cluster of 4,000 B200s, that data center becomes the single most important building in the country. It's a target.
Oh, absolutely. These aren't just data centers, they are fortresses. They have redundant power, physical hardening, and massive amounts of cybersecurity shielding. In Israel's case, they are likely integrating this into their existing national defense infrastructure. You don't just put a national supercomputer in a standard office park. You put it in a place that can survive a lot of external pressure, both digital and physical.
I read somewhere that some of these new sovereign data centers are being built underground or in decommissioned mines. Is that just for cooling, or is it for protection?
It's both. Cooling a cluster of B200s is a nightmare. Each chip can pull over 1,000 watts. When you have thousands of them, you're basically running a giant space heater. Being underground provides a natural heat sink and makes the liquid cooling systems much more efficient. But yeah, the bunker aspect is real. If your national AI is what runs your air traffic control, your power grid, and your financial markets, you can't have it sitting in a glass building in a city center.
Well, I for one am glad we have our own distributed cluster of two brothers and a very smart sloth brain to figure this out. It's a lot to process, pun intended. But it really highlights that the weird prompts Daniel sends us are often just the tip of a very large, very expensive, very fast iceberg. We're watching the birth of a new kind of state power.
It's a fascinating time to be watching this. The transition from AI as a cool tool to AI as national infrastructure is happening right now, in 2026, and the moves made this year will likely determine the economic pecking order for the next 50 years. It's not just about the chips, it's about the vision to use them to anchor a whole generation of researchers to their home soil.
On that high-stakes note, let's wrap this up. We've looked at the how, the distributed nodes and B200 chips, and the why, the strategic market gaps and talent funnels. It's a bold play. It's the startup nation trying to ensure it doesn't become the cloud renter nation.
A bold play indeed. And a huge thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping our own personal infrastructure running smoothly even when we go off on these hardware tangents.
Also, a big thanks to Modal for providing the GPU credits that power the generation side of this show. We might not be a national supercomputer, but we're doing our best with what we've got. If you're enjoying our deep dives, or just Herman's obsession with chip interconnects and exascale math, please leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. It really helps a lot.
This has been My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon with more from Daniel's brain to ours. We'll keep tracking the sovereign compute race as more countries join the fray.
Stay curious, and maybe don't try to build a supercomputer in your basement. The electricity bill is a killer, and your neighbors will definitely complain about the noise from the cooling fans. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This episode was produced using Google Gemini 3 Flash. Text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where our thoughts go from slow, slow takes to facts on QE. Change and follow through my weird prompts. That's the close from sloth.